We'll hear arguments first this morning in Jenkins against Anderson. Mr. Ziemba.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If there is one major shortcoming in the administration of the criminal law in this country, it is in the restricted interpretation given to the concept of the presumption of innocence. In my years at the criminal trial bar, I have so often heard trial judges instruct the jury that the defendant is presumed to be innocent and that the presumption starts at the beginning of the case and continues on through until his guilt is proven beyond a reasonable doubt, if ever. I think that that is a misleading, if not a mistaken, notion of the presumption of innocence. I think that we are all, as members of this society, presumed to be innocent of the commission of crime.
Well, didn't we say in Bell versus Wolfish last year that the presumption of innocence was something, a word of art, peculiar to criminal trials?
Yes, but I think that that's a restricted concept of it.
You disagree with
I agree with the court's declaration so far as the court went. But I would say that the reason why a police officer has to have probable cause to believe that somebody has committed a felony or to see the person commit a misdemeanor in his presence before he can lay hold of him is because that person is presumed to be innocent of the commission of crime. I think that the very genius of our system of criminal jurisprudence starts with the presumption of innocence which invests every member of our society. And it must follow from that in our system of jurisprudence, criminal jurisprudence, that if a person is presumed innocent, he cannot be burdened with the duty of proving his innocence. And therefore, if the state accuses a person of crime, the state has the burden of proving that crime. And then, of course, we evolve all of the facets of the principle of the right of non-incrimination on investing every individual, which means to say that if the state chooses to charge a person with crime, the state has the burden of proving that charge beyond a reasonable doubt without any assistance at all from the defendant. And there is no burden upon the defendant to make an explanation or to make exonerating statements or anything of that nature.
Well, now, the defendant can be called before a grand jury and required to give blood samples, handwriting analysis, that sort of thing, can he not?
That's true. But we have said that that is not testimonial in nature, have we not?
Yeah, but I take it the state wouldn't do it if it didn't feel it was helping prove its case.
Well, I suppose not. Of course, that is not to say that I am in absolute agreement with the concept that the giving of hair samples, blood samples, and things of this nature is not compelling a person to give evidence against himself. But, of course, I'm in the minority on that point of view. But we do recognize the fundamental principle that when one is hailed into court and put on trial, and all of the state's evidence marshaled against him is presented in court, he still has the right to remain silent. And nobody can comment upon that, upon the fact that he did remain silent.
But once he takes the stand in his own behalf, the situation undergoes some change, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But we cannot punish a person for exercising a constitutional right simply because he exercises another right, and that is the right to give evidence under the Sixth Amendment. In other words, here we have the potential of a person reading in the newspaper that the authorities suspect him of the commission of some crime. There's no formal charge laid against him, but still is bruited about that X has done so-and-so. Now, X must decide instantaneously that, before any charges are formally filed against him, whether he's going to testify on his trial if it ever should come to that, you see. Because if he intends to testify in his trial, he had better come out with an explanation in the face of these rumors and these stories in the newspapers now. Otherwise, he's going to be damned on trial by his pretrial silence in the face of these accusations. I do not think that that comports with our basic tenets and principles of fairness and justice. Now, if it is true, and it is true, that a person who was stopped on the street by a police officer and is asked questions about the commission of some crime has the perfect right not to answer the police officer, then how can we say that any duty devolves upon that person when he hears that he might be charged with crime or that he's suspected of the commission of crime, has a duty to seek out the police, go down to the police station, stop a police officer on the street, a scout car, and say, "One moment, please, you've got it all wrong. I acted in self-defense, or it was an accident, or I wasn't there, or whatever the case might be."
Didn't the lower court hold there was a duty on the part of the defendant to do any of these things?
No, but I think it's implied
that the failure to do them, if brought out on cross-examination, may undermine his credibility.
But doesn't that imply that one has a duty?
Not necessarily. I think he could have said, and the trial judge could have told the jury, he had no duty to go in and talk, and you should decide for yourselves whether there's any inconsistency between... I don't understand why you necessarily say there was a duty. The question is one of credibility, ultimately, isn't it?
But isn't it a matter of the credibility if a person is subpoenaed before a grand jury and he claims his right under the Fifth?
Well, that's right, but he wasn't summoned before the police and didn't assert any such right. He just didn't volunteer to go to the police.
I think it's an awfully strange doctrine, which says that if a person is hailed before a grand jury, he may exercise with impunity his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. If he's hailed before Congress or any investigatory body and he's propounded questions, he may exercise the Fifth Amendment to remain silent. If he is placed under arrest, whether he's given his Miranda warnings or not, he has the absolute right to refuse to answer questions. If he is stopped on the street, he has the absolute right under the Fifth Amendment not to answer any questions. And still, we say that if a person is sitting in his living room and he hears on television that he has been accused of crime, that there is a warrant out for his arrest, before he is arrested, he must ask to the telephone or down to the police station and make protestations.
Do you suggest you certainly don't suggest as a general rule of evidence that silence is irrelevant. Let's assume this was a civil case, and in the face of accusations, you remain silent. I thought the normal rule of evidence was that silence is a very, very relevant factor. And the only reason that silence isn't in criminal cases is just to the extent that the Fifth Amendment forbids it, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Well, isn't silence in civil cases a perfectly relevant matter to be brought out?
Yes, but you see, in civil cases, we are dealing with...
Well, I know, but that isn't because if there's any duty of anybody to talk.
No, but
it's because it's relevant, as Justice Stevens suggests.
But in civil cases, we're dealing with such inconsequential things as money and property rights and what have you. In criminal matters, we're dealing with life sometimes.
Yeah, but the only reason it's different in criminal cases is because of the Fifth Amendment.
Well,
it isn't because it's irrelevant or not meaningful. It's just
that that may be, Mr. Justice White.
Isn't your argument, though, that the Fifth Amendment forbids this? Isn't that the limit of your argument?
Yes. Well, and further, that the Fifth Amendment extends out into the community in all circumstances.
Well, Mr. Zemba, to take the last hypothesis that you proposed of someone sitting in his living room and hearing a radio broadcast that there had been a crime committed and perhaps he was a suspect, and he was ultimately indicted, tried, took the stand, and the prosecutor sought to impeach him because he had failed to rush down to the police station and to give his version. Don't you think the Supreme Court of Michigan would have decided this question on a non-constitutional ground, just that it's not relevant? It doesn't impeach the man's credibility for him to have failed to rush down to the police station?
I think that the Supreme Court of the state of Michigan would probably decide the case on the basis of People versus Bobo, who cited on page 26 of the petitioner's brief, where the court said, whether his defendant's silence was prior to or at the time of arrest makes little difference. The defendant's Fifth Amendment right to remain silent is constant. If silence in the face of specific accusation may not be used against a defendant, it would be a strange doctrine indeed that would permit silence absent such an accusation to be used as evidence of guilt. So
well,
I think they would.
Why did your client have to go to the federal courts to get relief here if the Supreme Court of Michigan feels that way?
So Justice White, Justice Rehnquist, I keep asking that question time and time again. My practice in the state of Michigan is almost exclusively criminal appellate work, and I cannot answer these questions. Why, in a certain case, the court will invoke the Constitution of the United States and of the state of Michigan and reverse the conviction, and in other cases where I can't discern any factual difference, the court gives me an unpublished per curiam opinion in which they say we examine the record and find no error. I have no explanation for that phenomenon. I'm sorry. But let us imagine two persons engaged in activity, and the police surprise them, and one is seized, and the other runs and makes good his escape. The one who is seized is immediately told by the police, "Now you have a right under the Constitution not to say anything." He's given his Miranda warning. And the second culprit has remained at liberty for 2 weeks. He hasn't come forth with any explanation, or he hasn't stopped any police officer, he hasn't gone into any police station. But eventually he's taken into custody and they're both placed on trial. The chap who had the misfortune or good fortune to be arrested at the scene and given his Miranda warnings, he can, with complete impunity, take the witness stand and give exculpatory evidence without being damned for exercising his right to silence. The fellow who is at liberty for 2 weeks, he gets on the stand and he is impeached. He is shown to be lying on trial because he remained silent during those 2 weeks he was at liberty.
It's a little more than that, isn't it, counsel? He didn't just remain silent. He fled from the scene of homicide situation.
Yes.
The man was stabbed to death.
Yes, which is not at all.
Remained without communication for 2 weeks. That kind of silence is a little different from just remaining silent after you've got a Miranda warning,
well,
isn't it?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
You know, when you make so much importance, you've devoted 10 minutes or 12 minutes to it. Did the trial counsel make an objection at the time this issue arose in the trial court?
No, he did not, John.
Was it raised in the first appeal?
In the petitioner here had court-appointed counsel on his appeal as a right to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and the specific issue before the court today was not raised to the Michigan Court of Appeals in appointed counsel's brief. You see, we have in the state of Michigan a procedural device available to the prosecution wherein the prosecution can file a motion to affirm the conviction on the basis that the issues raised by the appellant are so unsubstantial as not to need any formal submission and argument. And if the court agrees with the prosecutor, an order affirming the conviction might enter. And that was done in this case. The Court of Appeals of Michigan entered an order affirming the conviction on the basis of a motion to affirm by the prosecutor. Then the petitioner here, being dissatisfied with his appointed counsel's brief, filed a motion for an application for reconsideration to the Michigan Court of Appeals within the time allotted by the rules, and he raised this specific issue. And the application for leave for reconsideration was denied. The petitioner then proceeded pro se to make application to the Michigan Supreme Court in a discretionary appeal, and he presented this issue before the court, among others, to the Michigan Court of Michigan Supreme Court, and the Michigan Supreme Court denied leave to appeal, stating that they are not persuaded that the questions should be reviewed by that court. Now, I might point this out, that the state of Michigan, neither in the Court of Appeals nor in the Michigan Supreme Court, nor in the Federal District Court on the petition for writ of habeas corpus, nor on the appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, raised the issue that there was failure to make a contemporaneous objection at trial. In other words, that issue has never been raised in this case until it has come here on the petition for certiorari. And I think that if the defendant is chargeable for neglecting to object on on trial, the state of Michigan is chargeable for not raising that objection any place during the appellate procedures and processes until it's come before this court. And I might point this out further, Your Honor, that in the state of Michigan we do have a plain error doctrine. And it is invoked most frequently when constitutional rights are involved. So that the Michigan Court of Appeals and or the Michigan Supreme Court could have entertained this question and reversed the conviction even in the absence of an objection by the petitioner at the trial level.
But they didn't.
Well, they did. They did not. No. So I respectfully submit that should not be considered to be an issue before this court. Now, Your Honor, I have never killed an individual, to my knowledge, but I would guess that any kind of a killing of a human being must be an emotionally disturbing thing. And I know this from my practice in the criminal law in the city of Detroit, that a young black person who is involved in a homicide is not going to be terribly anxious to fall into the hands of the police officers. He's going to be frightened. It's a natural reaction for any individual.
I draw from that a white person would be.
Well, I don't know, but I'm arguing the facts in this particular case, Mr. Justice. Here we have a black petitioner. He argued that he was frightened. He was so frightened of the police that he, before he turned himself in, he made arrangements with the black mayor of the city of Detroit to surrender himself through the mayor's office because he was afeard. Now,
did he have a prior criminal record?
I'm not sure. He might have had, Your Honor, not a serious one.
Well, there's some...
Yes, no. In point of fact, I recall it, Your Honor. He gave the explanation that he was, in addition, fearful that because he had been placed on probation here just recently by one of the judges of the Recorder's Court of the City of Detroit. So he did have a. A prior criminal record, but of course...
Well, he was not wholly unfamiliar with the criminal process.
Your Honor, I don't think that when an unschooled individual goes through a criminal proceeding, a case, one time, that he is necessarily thoroughly educated in the principles and the processes of the criminal law. I don't think that person can then be judged to be one who is familiar with the criminal law and criminal processes. So that the jury in this case, in point of fact, the petitioner was charged with murder of the first degree. The jury took four and a half days to come back with a verdict of manslaughter. In the state of Michigan, we have murder of the first degree, second degree, and then voluntary manslaughter. Now, it was the defendant's testimony which was crucial to this case. He asserted a defense of self-defense. He said that he stabbed in self-defense. Now, if we his impeachment by the prosecutor in the form that we find in this case seriously undermined his credibility in the eyes of the lay juries, and that's where the basic unfairness and the violation of the constitutional principle is involved. Are there any further questions?
I notice from the record that there apparently was no objection to the prosecutor's references to his...
There were no objections to the arguments of the prosecutor referring to the exercise by the petitioner of his right to silence. There was not, Your Honor, no.
But there, you say that this... at least I got the impression you said this case turned entirely on his testimony. The jury had the choice of believing witnesses, eyewitnesses brought by the prosecution and eyewitnesses produced by the defense. And these witnesses were in complete conflict with each other, were they not, as to who had the knife in the first place?
Yes, I would say that was a fair representation, Mr. Chief Justice.
The jury verdict came down to whether they were going to believe one set of witnesses or believe another set of witnesses.
My experience is that a jury wants to hear from the defendant what's his side of the story, you see? And it's very, very important, I think, in a criminal case, to put the defendant on the stand. If I possibly can put a defendant on the stand, I will put him on the stand because the chances of winning without putting the defendant on the stand are materially reduced, you see. Now, the defendant gets on the stand and he swears, you see, that the deceased had the knife and that the deceased was coming at the petitioner because the petitioner had reported that the deceased had committed this crime a few days earlier, and that he tussled and wrestled with the petitioner, and he turned, tussled and wrestled with the deceased, and turned the knife of the deceased on the deceased and stabbed him with his own knife, you see? Now, it's my impression that jurors come to jury service invested with a thick patina of folk wisdom. For instance, you can instruct the jury until the cows come home that a defendant need not prove his alibi. That's the law in the state of Michigan. That it is sufficient if the evidence on alibi raises a reasonable doubt as to the presence of the defendant on the scene of the crime when it was committed. But nonetheless, it is a fact of jury trials that if the jury believes that the alibi witnesses are lying, they'll say, oh, he must be guilty because they are lying. You see. And so they also come to a jury trial with the preconception that if a defendant has nothing to fear, if he's not guilty, why doesn't he get up on that witness stand and say so? Why doesn't he get up there and deny his guilt, you see? And then when the defendant gets on the witness stand and the prosecutor says, you can't believe him, you can't believe him, because if what he was telling you in court today is true, he would have come voluntarily into the police department so soon after that homicide as he possibly could get and explain, you've got it all wrong, I acted in self-defense, you see? And that's where the maliciousness of the whole thing.
Mr. Stanley, may I ask you about this, the extent of your position in the case? You don't rely at all, as I listen to your argument, on the Doyle case.
I do to this extent that the Doyle case is correct, but the Doyle case seems to say that the police invent constitutional rights when they inform a defendant of his Miranda rights.
Well, Doyle was due process.
You
think it was Fifth Amendment?
Well, I'm sure there was Fifth Amendment in there someplace. The court said you can't tell the man that he has a right under the Fifth Amendment not to incriminate himself and then on trial damn him because he exercised his right. This is certainly a part of the law.
It's a sequel to the Miranda case.
Yes, I would say it's a progeny, as we say, of Miranda.
Miranda.
Certainly. Miranda didn't invent
and
any...
And this case now before us is not. There's that difference in there.
Yes, but I would say this, that Miranda didn't invent any new constitutional rights.
No. But
you see? All Miranda says was,
well,
look...
one can question whether or not it did, but you submit that it did.
In my view, all that Miranda says is, look, when the police take a person into custody, inform him of the fact that he has a right to remain silent. Because otherwise, he may not know, and he may be frightened into making a statement, you see. But if a person is taken into custody, and he's a constitutional scholar, and he remains silent even if he's not given his Miranda warnings, why do we shorn him of his right to remain silent, exercise his Fifth Amendment right? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, is it your view, I just want to be sure I understand your theory, is it your view that any time the defendant has a constitutional right to remain silent and does so, notwithstanding how relevant that silence may be to some issue in the case, the prosecutor may never bring out the fact of silence because he has a constitutional right to maintain his silence?
Precisely. So, Justice Stevens, I respectfully submit that if a person has a right to remain silent, then there is no duty ever imposed upon him to speak. His silence can never be inconsistent with innocence. After all, we say that
as speaking might incriminate.
Well, in this case...
Well, isn't that right? You would qualify your statement.
That is the basic.
If you're relying on the Fifth Amendment,
underlying. Yes,
that is the protection against self-incrimination.
Right,
compels self-incrimination.
That's true. You see, if a person is presumed to be innocent, and if a person has the right to remain silent, then how can we ever say that he has a duty, under any circumstances, in the face of rumors or accusations of crime, to come forward and give explanations? Under penalty that if he should be placed on trial for criminal charges and he gets up on the witness stand, he will be damned for the exercise of his constitutional right to remain silent.
Not necessarily. He may give quite a good explanation that satisfies the jury as to why he waited 2 weeks before he moved.
But why should he have to do that, Mr. Chief Justice? Everybody, if he's exercising a constitutional right, why should he have to give anybody an explanation as to why he exercised that constitutional right? What's the value of a constitutional right if you have to go around explaining why?
Nobody's claiming he had to do it.
Well, the prosecutor certainly was.
All the prosecutor was saying was that the fact that he didn't do it is relevant in an evidentiary sense in deciding whether or not he was telling the truth at the trial.
I'm sorry, but I'm so logically constructed that I cannot see any difference between saying that and saying you had a duty.
I regret my illogic.
No, it's.
You say it would just be a contradiction in terms if you added to the Miranda warnings that you tell him that you have the right to remain silent, have a right to a lawyer, and so on, but that if you remain silent, that your silence may be used against you. Now, let's assume he's warned to that effect. You would say, even so, you couldn't use his silence to impeach him at trial.
Well, if we came to laying down a rule like that, I would just throw up my hands and say, I just don't understand the law. I just don't understand the law.
Mr. Ziemba,
yes.
Supposing that your defendant, your client, got on the witness stand and testified that immediately after the killing, he went to the police chief and told him that it was self-defense and what happened. And he, in fact, had been silent, had not gone to the police chief. Could the police chief get on the stand and say, this man remained silent?
Oh, definitely. You see, because he's gotten on the witness stand and told a deliberate falsehood.
Well, but that's what the theory of the state is here, that he got on the stand and told a deliberate falsehood that's inconsistent with his silence.
No.
You disagree with it, but that's their theory.
I see.
You see, the ultimate question for the jury to decide is whether or not the defendant is telling the truth or not, you see. It's not for the prosecutor. Do I sit down?
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Solicitor General.
Chief Justice, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Bearing in mind that the most basic tenet of the Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate yourself is compulsion, the state of Michigan takes the position that in this cause there is no Fifth Amendment violation. This man was not compelled to testify against himself. The contention is that by exploring his flight and concealment, that his, quote, silence, end quote, was infringed upon. I have difficulty in conceiving this voluntary flight and voluntary concealment to be in the category of silence, certainly not in the testimonial sense. And then to contend that once he exercises his Sixth Amendment right, takes the stand with counsel at his side, and testifies, and speaks of his absence. He brought it all up, that we are barred from cross-examining him on that issue. Incidentally, of the 30 or more pages of the testimony given by this man, less than a page, I think. It's only less than a page in the appendix concerning the examination by the prosecution on cross-exam of this flight and concealment. I doubt whether it had any serious impact upon the jury at all. In fact, keep in mind that this man was charged under Michigan law with first-degree murder, conviction of which requires a mandatory life sentence. But evidently his story of an alibi, or self-defense rather, did have some impact upon the jury. They came in and found him guilty of manslaughter, which is a 10 to 15 year sentence, which he did receive. Now, it's not a Doyle case at all. Doyle held that because of the oppressive conditions of the police station and the features thereof, that once he is given his Miranda warning and so forth, that you couldn't infringe upon that and make mention of that. But here in this case, he brought it up. There was no compulsion, no Fifth Amendment problem involved. This court, way back in many years ago, I think in a raffle, said that once an accused takes the stand, the prosecution has full sway in the matter of issues pertinent to the cause and may cross-examine thereon. I move along a bit to perhaps maybe a knottier problem involved here, and in Doyle it was the a due process question. The question is whether did the probative value of examining him on his escape and concealment, or flight and concealment, did that outweigh the prejudice that was done to him? I would have to say no, and I think the finding of a lesser guilty of a lesser offense definitely proves that. Was there such a fundamental unfairness in his trial? I think not. Oh, the judge or the prosecutor made the rather, shall I say, tacky remark that perhaps during his flight and concealment he was lining up witnesses. I think he also referred to that in one sentence in his summation to the jury. But you know, that is not all bad. That's a perfectly normal thing for a person. He explained he was frightened. That's another explanation for his flight and concealment. And perhaps the jury did believe him that he was frightened, and that is the reason why he fled. Now, it would certainly be a most normal thing. I would certainly not take exception to the claim that any intelligent person running off like that would sure try and line up some witnesses. That would be the intelligent thing and not necessarily a meretricious act. But to contend that a person may be involved in a felony and then go off, escape for more than 2 weeks, conceal himself, come back and give a self-defense plea when his flight and concealment was certainly inconsistent with such a plea, to permit that, I say that the court would certainly handcuff prosecuting authorities throughout this country in many, many cases.
Well, whether it was inconsistent with his plea or not was a matter for the jury to decide.
Yes, sir, and they made their selection.
And you suggest that they were influenced to the extent that they reduced this by two grades, from first-degree murder down to manslaughter.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I say without, with the acceptance of a theory such as that and making it part of the law of this nation, I say the handcuffing of prosecuting authorities would certainly occur. I can foresee where all you'd have to do is skip out, stay concealed, take the stand with some plausible self-defense witnesses,
Do you think that a man charged with a crime is obliged to on his own come in and give himself up?
Oh, no, sir. I don't think there is any constitutional duty of that, sir. I do not.
I thought that's what you were saying.
No, sir.
I misunderstood you. I'm sorry.
No, sir. No, I say that we have the right, once he takes the stand, to attempt to cast doubt upon his self-defense plea. And his escape and concealment is certainly an act inconsistent, and that's been generally held, with a plea of self-defense. Unless the court has any questions, I conclude.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Owen.